Last bunch of visitors. This next session is going to be about the prison industrial complex and police abuse. I'd like to just, first of all, apologize for one of our speakers who couldn't make it today. Richard Trujillo from the California Justice Center was unable to make it here today because they are so busy organizing for the demonstration on the 16th. And in his stead, I'm going to just give some short information about the problem of prison labor. This is why it's so important to have this session here about the prison industrial complex. It's because a lot of us are beginning to feel, in California especially, but in other states as well, that the prison industrial complex is becoming the new slavery, where they're herding in our youths and our people of color with Proposition 21 into prisons where they'll work for companies like Victoria's Secret, TWA, McDonald's, JCPenney, Starbucks, and others at pennies per hour. These are the same jobs that these corporations would not let these young people have for $9 or $10 an hour so they could go to school, learn a trade, support a family. There is some really good information out there on the internet. The Justice Policy Institute has some information. These will be over at the table of committees of correspondence after this plenary. Another internet site called The New Capitalism also has some information. This is available to us, the public, so that we can find out why exactly they're building prisons and why exactly young people have no jobs. And I'm about to introduce one of our panelists, Janice Jordan from California Coalition of Women Prisoners. And she's going to give some information about a tape that that speaks to this issue and also talk a little about, in general, about this women's problems in prisons.
Good afternoon. Real quick, just to reflect on what she was talking about, prison labor. I have this great 7-minute promo tape up here. It was put up by the Joint Venture Program. And those of you who are not familiar with it, the Joint Venture Program is a national organization that sends this 7-minute tape into prisons and to businesses. Specifically to the businesses, it states why they should break down their industry on the outs and put it on the in. And what we have just witnessed recently is actually a John Deere plant laid off, I think, something like 200 workers and it went inside a prison. Now, when you see this tape, if you don't watch it from the beginning, I've actually had friends walk in on it and thought it was a satire. I'm selling it for $7, about the cost that I had to make it for, and I guarantee you will laugh and throw up at the same time. Seriously. I want to talk a little bit about women prisoners. Regardless of what you think, women are the fastest growing prison population in the U.S. We are still lower in numbers, but we are growing at 6.5% a year. Men are growing about 4.7% a year. California is home to the two world's largest prisons, and they're both in Chowchilla. Chowchilla State Prison and Valley State. It's disgusting. Not only what's going on in the women's prisons are medical abuse and neglect and physical abuse. A woman will go in for a broken arm, she gets a pap smear. A woman goes in for a headache, she gets a pap smear. Ted Koppel actually exposed this last November. It was a great Nightline segment, and I'm sorry that I don't have any of those tapes with me. But he interviewed the doctor who oversaw the doctors and nurses who were giving these pap smears. The administrator's response was, "This is the only male contact the women prisoners get." Now, he was not fired from his job. He was reassigned up to Sacramento, overseeing the medical efficiency of the administration of these women prisons. This is disgusting, what's going on. You have a headache, you go to see an EMT, which is just another prison guard. They have no experience on what it means to look at your body or to talk to you as a doctor or any type of registered nurse was, as there is no full-time registered nurse or full-time registered doctor, you might get an aspirin 3 days later. This is completely unacceptable. 75% of the women that are incarcerated are there for nonviolent crimes, as of men. Most men that are incarcerated, nonviolent crimes, what we call victimless crimes, selling pot, possession, maybe robbery, I'm not talking strong-arm robbery, robbery. We are not seeing rehabilitation anymore. Education has been stripped, not only in men's facilities, but women's facilities. Unfortunately, who's affected the most when a woman goes to prison is her child. And 80% of the women that are in prison have at least one child. And you know what happens to those kids? They're sent to the state. Maybe a grandparent will raise them if somebody has that luxury. What's even sadder is a woman who goes into prison who's pregnant. If she gives birth while she's in prison, she is shackled to the gurney while she's giving birth. This is horrible. This is extreme physical abuse. Now, for those women who've gone through labor, imagine what it would be like sitting with your legs up in the air, shackled, while you're giving birth to your child. If you don't have a family member, and they have to prove that they're a family member, if you don't have a family member that picks up that child within 48 hours, you know where that child goes? To the state. Luckily, when Ted Koppel was doing this, and I think it's only because he did this interview, there was a woman there who didn't have a valid family member to come pick up her child. Her partner was also in prison, who she was not married to, and her partner's mother came to pick up the child. The state was going to refuse to recognize her as a grandmother because they weren't married. But I think it's because Ted Koppel was there, she was actually able to hand the child over to this woman. Now, she's not handing it directly to this grandmother. She can't even see her family member that she's giving the child to. A sheriff comes in, takes the baby away, gives it to this grandmother as they sign papers, like it's just a piece of property, and off they go. It's the most devastating effect for me as a parent to watch another woman go through that. I have 1 minute, 6 minutes goes by fast. I would encourage you to get involved in whichever way you can. Women, right now, I know overall we've built 22 new prisons in the state of California, one state university. That's completely unacceptable. What they are saying to us is that our children have a better chance of going to prison than they do in education. And my daughter, who is of mixed race, is one of those statistics. And I am scared for her. I actually thought when Proposition 21 passed, she's going to become a target. She's already pissed off at the cops. And what's going to happen when she becomes a 15-year-old black woman, real mouthy on the corner, and just speaking out for her rights, they're going to throw her in. And that's already happening. A week after Proposition 21 was passed, young girls were already being sent to women's state facility. Get involved in whichever way you can. I've got lots of literature up here, specifically the case on Teresa Cruz, who we're doing a vigil and a parole board hearing call-in day. Come see me. I'll be up here all night long. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. We've all heard lately about the problem of drugs in communities and communities on drugs. Here to speak about the specifics of the economics that are driving, undermining communities with drugs is a well-known speaker, Michael Rupert. He's from the Wilderness Publications, a former policeman, and he knows pretty much everything, so I'll let him speak.
Well, it's nice to be told that I know pretty much everything. I'll have to ask myself some questions later on. Let me throw a few facts out to you that will maybe put some things in perspective, because when we talk about the prison industrial complex and we talk about the economics of the whole thing, we're talking about an economic ecosystem. Many of you know that this year the United States became a nation which imprisons 2 million of its citizens. 1 million of those have been at it in the last decade, and of those, 60 to 70% are nonviolent drug offenders. And again, you're absolutely right about the increasing number of women in prison who are also serving, in effect, the slave labor role, taking airline reservations, doing data processing for the Department of Justice, working for maybe a buck, maybe $2 an hour. But let me throw out some other numbers for you. Now you can hear probably as well as the FBI can. Le Monde, one of the best publications in the world for investigative journalism, has come up with this figure. The UN said it was $440 billion in 1996. The Department of Justice estimates it at between $400 and $500 billion a year. But I like the figure of a half a trillion dollars a year. $500 billion a year passes in the drug trade. That money gets laundered. It moves through the economy. And I have documented in my publication From the Wilderness how much of that money ends up in Wall Street, buoying the Dow Jones Industrial Average. You may not know that last July, a year ago, the president of the New York Stock Exchange, Richard Grasso, went to Colombia and visited the FARC guerrillas and asked them to invest their drug profits in Wall Street. And we are rushing headlong toward a war in Colombia even as we speak.
Did they agree to do it?
No, they did not. Now, there's quite a bit to the way this all feeds in, but what's important to understand is that when President Richard Nixon started the war on drugs in 1972, the federal budget allocation at the federal level for law enforcement was $101 million. As we entered fiscal year 2000, the federal law enforcement budget allocation for the war on drugs was $17 billion. And yet, there are more drugs in this country today, and they are cheaper, and they are more potent than they were in 1972. What's wrong with the picture? Well, first of all, while it's illegal to move $10,000 in cash and the banking industry has to report cash transactions for money laundering, there is no requirement at all on the securities industry. And we document heavily, and please visit us at our table back in the back From the Wilderness. We've got lots of information on this, how it's used to support Wall Street. But now let's turn to the other side of the coin, and let's use a model from right here in Los Angeles. I've only got about, 3 minutes left, I think. So here in Los Angeles, we're all familiar with the Gary Webb stories from 1996 about Freeway Ricky Ross, who was the so-called godfather of crack cocaine, and how the CIA was directly tied to what became an absolute epidemic of crack cocaine use in South Central Los Angeles. By the way, for those of you who don't know, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just ruled in favor of Contra leader Renato Pena, based on information generated from that there is direct validity to his claims that the agency was running drugs, and he's now entitled to an evidentiary hearing. The U.S. Ninth Circuit read the same reports we've all read that the major media missed and said it's true. But now I want to use a model for you. I've had right for me in my publication, From the Wilderness, a former Assistant Secretary of Housing, Catherine Austin Fitz, who documented, and we published a very dramatic map in the May 1999 issue of single-family home loan defaults in South Central Los Angeles. And if you look at this map, we have it at my table, you see that South Central is just a blot of single-family home loans that defaulted, meaning that as young African Americans were going to jail for prison, the rich people who were bringing in the cocaine for the CIA said, let's use their money to steal their homes and put them in jail so they can pay us to steal their property. Because what happened was, as the hardworking middle-class families in South Central Los Angeles found their $100,000 homes worth $30,000 in the middle of a crack epidemic, they defaulted. And just a few years later, somebody else conveniently making large political campaign contributions bought those same houses for pennies on the dollar. And that's how the wealth gets stolen and recycled. If I were to make it simple, I would say kill the Indians and take the land. Kill the Indians and take the land. But even more so, put them in prison. And that's what's important about this complex. And it is a complex of prison industrial labor which now generates prisoners, because the other half of that, the other portion of that $17 billion equation on the drug war is the $13 billion that's spent on prisons to house inmates who work for pennies on the dollar, taking reservations for TWA or processing credit card orders for Citibank. And that $13 billion, somebody said, you know, somebody has a headache, you get a pap smear, and they bill them, and psychiatrists make $45,000 or $50,000, $60,000, and the largest lobby in this state is prison guards right now. Now, this is an essential thing to understand, because all of this is fueled by one thing, which is the prohibition of illegal drugs and the value that is placed on those drugs, just exactly the way it was done with Prohibition in the 20s. And the way to pull the plug on the whole system is to decriminalize drugs. Everything. As we get ready to go to war in Colombia, we're going to see maybe 10,000 people maybe come to this convention the next time when their children are getting ready to go fight in Colombia. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. When entire communities are targeted as exploitable, cheap prison labor, or targeted as expendable altogether, police brutality and harassment in those communities will increase. Here to talk about police brutality and organized community fight back is Joey Johnson of the October 22nd Coalition.
Thank you very much. I'm going to get right to the point because I think this is very important what people are doing here today. But what I want to focus up on is not so much like the problem of what's happening, because I think every day people, the news is filled with it, but more like what are we going to do about it? Because in 1996, I was part of a group of a number of people from coast to coast who decided that really there was an epidemic of police brutality going on and that something needed to be done about it and that we needed to do it on a nationwide basis, because police brutality, for too long, people had been fighting it kind of like case by case or city by city or incident by incident. We decided we needed to nationwide bring together a movement of all those forces that were organizing against police brutality. So we initiated the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And the significance of October 22nd was that was the date upon which the first National Day of Protest was in 1996. And we've kept that date and we've kept that name. And in the years that have transpired, the National Day of Protest has grown. From here in L.A., the first year was about 250 people. To the second year, it was about 750 people. In the third year, in 1998, it was 1,500 people. And this past October 22nd, it was over 3,000 people marching to Parker Center, the headquarters of the LAPD, and condemning them for their brutality and murders of so many people, countless numbers of people throughout Los Angeles, and along with other police agencies throughout Southern California. So this coalition, the October 22nd Coalition, we feel like it brings two unique contributions to the movement to stop police brutality. And that's really what we all need to be about, not trying to lessen it a little bit or lighten it up a little bit, but really how are we going to stop it? How are we going to put an end to it? And we feel that nationwide there needs to be a movement, and we've been making progress in bringing that into being and strengthening it from coast to coast and providing a platform for the family members, especially family members of people that have been murdered by the police, for their stories to be told and to be heard. And we feel that this movement needs to become even more organized, even stronger, because as you all know, they're still out there murdering people. They haven't backed up off of it. And so that means what we've done has been important and significant, but it's not enough, and we need to take it higher, and we need to take it further. But there's two unique contributions that I feel that the October 22nd Coalition brings to this movement against police brutality nationwide. One is the National Day of Protest on October 22nd, and the other is the Stolen Lives Project. This is a book that I want you all to know about, and some I'm sure already do. It's called Stolen Lives, and it's a listing of over 2,000 names of people that have been murdered by the police in this country since 1990. This was a project that the October 22nd Coalition undertook in conjunction with the National Lawyers Guild and the Anthony Baez Foundation. For those that don't know, Anthony Baez was a young Puerto Rican man in New York City who was murdered by a NYPD police chokehold because his football landed on a cop's car. So what our coalition set out to do was to document so that people that would say, oh, this is just an isolated incident, it's not as widespread as you're saying, we say, no, here it is, right here. And so we began compiling the cases from going out to rallies, from talking to police brutality attorneys, from taking clippings from newspapers, from whatever source that we could, and began to compile this list. And you should know that in 1994, the Justice Department was instructed to undertake this project by Congress, and yet they never actually did it. I wonder why. You know, I think because this is damaging information. It puts a human face. It puts a human face on something that the powers that be want to deny is taking place. So the Stolen Lives Project, and along with it, What we try to do is provide a platform for the families, as I said, of people that have been murdered, to speak, you know, to have their stories heard and projected out to society as a whole. And we do that every year on October 22nd on the National Day of Protest, and we do it throughout the year by networking with other family members and other struggles against police brutality that are going on in different places, like in Riverside, and the murder of Taisha Miller, which is something our coalition has been very involved in, or here, the whole Rampart scandal and what it has revealed about what we've been saying all along, and that many people tried to dismiss, that the police routinely plant weapons on people, frame people, shoot unarmed people in the head, and then write their police report and their cover up while the person lays there and bleeds to death, like what happened with a young brother named Juan Saldana, living in the Pico Union area, who was murdered by Rampart cops. One thing our coalition did was to put out a statement against the Rampart murders and mayhem by the LAPD, and we distributed over 50,000 of these in English and 20,000 in Spanish through our neighborhoods and barrios, you know, in Los Angeles. Just one last point I want to make around this prison industrial complex, because I feel like it's a controversial issue and stuff. We all have agreement that there's mass incarceration going on. The thing we have a difference on is like what's motivating it. I don't believe that it's sufficient as analysis to say that the reason that we have the most unprecedented mass prison expansion in the history of this country is because of the corporations trying to make profit off of it within the jail system. Actually, if you look at the statistics, the prison population in this country, I'm going to wrap real quick, has gone from 200,000 in 1980 to 2 million this year. Of that, only about 5% of those people are involved in prison labor. Really, what I think is going on is we have to look at this whole process of capitalist globalization and the fact that the imperialists are sending all these factories all over the world so they don't have a place to profitably exploit millions and millions of young people. And they got national security concerns. They got concerns about social upheaval if those youth are out on the street. So that to me is that's like getting more hit in the nail on the head in terms of why do we face this unprecedented expansion of the prison system, application of the death penalty, on and on. I'm calling everybody, come out for the protests on August 16th at the Democratic Convention Wednesday. The theme of the day is fighting against police brutality, protesting against police brutality, and come out on October 22nd for the National Day of Protest and Literature and all that's here. Thank you.
Thanks, Joey. In any area of social change, and particularly when we're fighting the capitalist-owned police state, it's important that entire communities become educated and organized. And today we're fortunate enough to have with us a woman who has had extensive experience in doing just that, organizing and educating her community. Tilda Sosaya works with Committee on Prison Accountability in New Mexico, and she's here today. Tilda Sosaya.
Hi. I have to apologize for running in on Janice's talk. I got lost. I'm not from Los Angeles, and it's a little difficult getting around when you don't know your way. I'm new to organizing, actually, and this is a very grassroots process that I became engaged in last autumn. We had a major incident in one of our prisons, and I might tell you this as an antecedent. 5 years ago, we had three prisons in New Mexico, and they were all state-owned. Today, we have five private prisons in New Mexico. And our governor, Gary Johnson, will soon be speaking at the Shadow Convention. And he's being touted as the poster boy for drug reform across the country. I don't mean to invalidate his ideas, because he does have some good ideas. But I will say that we must beware, because where there's smoke, there's fire, as we all know. I have a few notes here that I need to find before I can go on. As I said, in New Mexico, we had only three prisons until 5 years ago. In this 5 years, a few other things have happened. The rate of incarceration among men has taken a jump of 36%, but among women, it has jumped 116% in 5 years. Imprisonment has a history, as everything does, and there are reasons for it. And we look back on how people have been punished over the years, and we have to realize one basic thing, and that is being removed from the community, from the home and family, is the punishment. Prison is the punishment. And this is what I try more than anything else to bring across to the public. We are a group basically of families. My son is an inmate in New Mexico, and we came together after a riot had occurred in the fall. It was a tragic time. Men were sent from New Mexico 2,000 miles away to a huge, overwhelmingly horrible fortress, a level 6 super maximum security unit. Families were up in arms. They didn't know their loved ones were being taken until they saw them on television lying on the tarmac with armed guards all around them, SWAT teams, SORT teams, DART teams, and CERT teams. What are all these acronyms? What do they mean? Who employs them, and where do they come from? These are questions everyone began to ask, and they needed answers. And people were very, very upset. We had an ACLU meeting, and we organized from that day onward. And it was mid-September, just a couple weeks after this incident had occurred. From that point on, it was finding ways and means of getting support from the community, which is really difficult because prisoners are our least popular citizens. We went out and talked to legislators. We went out and talked to other community leaders, and we began to make our voices heard by demonstrating, by taking it to the streets, making signs, carrying posters, shouting chants, and generally making a nuisance in front of the state capitol building. We did a major campaign in October. We did another one in December, which was a Christmas vigil. It was 1 week before Christmas. It was candlelight. In New Mexico, we have a custom of using farolitos to greet friends as they come to our house. You take a little paper sack and you fill it with sand and you put a candle in it, and those are farolitos, and you light them. So we lined the whole stage and stairway down at Civic Plaza in the middle of Albuquerque and had about 60 people show up for our demonstration, and that was televised, and it was one of the good moments. Generally, we're ignored. The press does not want to pay attention to us because the powers that be don't want them to. On July 15th, there was a nationwide prison reform unity project that came about as a result of a group of women who had met one another online. One woman said, what if we decided to choose one day when all of us take to the streets? What if we all stood in front of our prisons in our states and said, no more? And that what if grew into a coalition, and that coalition successfully gathered large numbers of people all over the country. I think y'all in California had everyone way beat at Chowchilla. But in New Mexico, which is a relatively small state, we succeeded in bringing out about 150 people. There were 30 or so armed guards. We have 5 prisons in one spot, a medium maximum, and now a new supermax, and a jail across the way. We had probably 8 to 10 armed guards in front of each of those facilities. They would not let us near. Our demonstration took place on the back of a pickup truck with a bullhorn and speakers jumping up and down from the bed of that pickup truck. All in all, it was a pretty exciting moment because we were able to get some press, to get some word out to people. And as a result, we've been invited now more. I go to places and talk to 12 people in a nursing home. And those 12 people will then pick up the phone and help us out. And I think that's the way you organize. It's person to person. It's very individual sometimes. And it's got to come from the heart. If you don't have it here, you're never going to get it out this way. So I thank you for your time, and I'm really happy to have been here with you today. Thank you.
Matilda, thank you very much. Someone drew my attention to the fact that it's painfully obvious and painfully apparent that there are no black people on this panel when this is an issue that affects the black community maximally. And I apologize for that. We had invited Michael Zinzin from Coalition Against Police Abuse to speak. He was very busy and could not make it and sends his regrets. We also invited Twilight Bay. He's one of the initiators of the Los Angeles gang truce between the Bloods and the Crips. And he's very articulate, and we've been playing telephone tag for a week and a half, and he could not make this particular time. But those were two of the people that would have or could have or should have been on this panel, and others were asked. I just wanted to acknowledge that this was not an oversight or an error. This was a logistical problem. There's a special problem of people who fight back against the system, people like Janice, people like Sosaya, people like all of us in our communities. We can be targeted as agitators. And the special types of imprisonment and harassment that await folks who are targeted as agitators and troublemakers to the system are known by all of us. Many of us have worked on the Leonard Peltier campaign or the Mumia campaign. We have here Jean Day, a national spokesperson for the Leonard Peltier campaign, who would like to say a few words about Linton.
Good afternoon. I just got in from Wisconsin, and I, too, got lost. But I want to thank you for all the work that you have done for Leonard already. Because of your voices and what you've done, Leonard's health is now getting a little better. For many years, he walked around with a frozen jaw, and now he's able to move it. Now he's able to start eating protein, of which he really needed really bad. This past June 12th, a group of us went into the prison to go and visit Leonard, not only to visit Leonard, to have a parole review. Before we even walked out of the prison, the answer came back to us, no. This is the second time. 1998 was the first time he had a parole review, and then, of course, this year, 2000. We've been doing many things legally to get things going for Leonard, even bringing on new attorneys to help work on his case. Some of the things I heard talk about today are, I'm going to give you some of the things that Leonard and I would talk about. He went and he said, you know, the prison systems, the largest reservation that's growing now is in the prison system. That means many of our brothers and sisters, indigenous people here in this continent, are now in prisons. There was another comment about, kill the Indians, take the land. Well, baby, we're still here, and we're not leaving. And when you look at Leonard's case, the biggest reason Leonard is in prison is because he stood up. He was targeted even before we went into Oglala, even before we started living there. Some of the things we did there in that community was help organize it, to get it going to a point where they were afraid to stand up because they knew we were standing behind them. They knew we were standing next to them, and they knew Leonard was going to be there to help protect him too. And we did that. But out of that came his imprisonment. His two other co-defendants are free right now on acquittals of self-defense. And that's some of the things that need to be brought up more into communities of the truth of really what happened to us during that time. During that time, we were just a group of everyday common citizens like you. And probably in some of your own homes, you have to have weapons in your home to protect your home. Well, we did too. But we didn't do it where we were, what they call us, dog soldiers, mercenaries. Mercenaries, I think from the Webster Dictionary, said somebody that you get paid for. We didn't get paid nothing. But we did find out a lot of things out there about ourselves and being Native American people. And that's what I want to say about the Lakota people, is they really helped us and taught us many things. It had not been for the people of Ogallala, more people would have died that day. Not just Joe Stuntz, but more people would have died. I'm going to bring another thing in here that we've been really working on right now, is that Leonard only has maybe 5 months. We've had executive clemency on Clinton's desk for 7.5 years. We only have 5 more months before he is no longer president. It is very, very vital that we get Leonard out of prison now. After seeing Leonard and knowing him 25 years ago, his hope is that he will be free before the end of the year or before Clinton leaves office. My fear, and always this has been a fear, that he won't be. If he won't be out by that time, when you look at Leonard's sentence, it was two life sentences served consecutively. That means he wouldn't be out until 2045. Leonard's going to be 56 next month. I don't think he's going to make it. So right now, in order to keep his spirits up, we on the Defense Committee and those people who are out there working for him have to let him know how much work we're doing in order for him to be free. I want every one of you, for our campaign for the last year was to call on regional days. Certain regions will call into the White House. I am asking you to do it every day. It doesn't cost that much. And the phone number is 202-456-1111. I know it real well. And to write postcards to the White House demanding executive clemency for Leonard Peltier. Leonard, I do not want to see die in prison. We are asking to the president. He went over to India and said, let the Muslims and the Hindus heal of all the things that have been going on in the country of India. Well, they called us Indians because they thought they were India. Well, I'm asking the President of the United States to begin that healing between indigenous people here in the United States and the United States government, of him being the first president to say, we are really sorry for what we've done to you as a government, and I'm going to free Leonard Peltier. And that is the message I want to send to him. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean Day, and thanks to all our panelists. The way we thought we'd handle the discussion, we wanted the maximum input from y'all. You're not an audience. You're organizers. You're participants. You get 2 minutes to ask questions, make resolutions, raise a point that this discussion might have caused you to think of. And if you'd like one of the panelists to respond, we get 1 minute. A microphone is being set up over there. And if possible, we'd like folks to use some gender balance with this and go boy, girl, so not only guys get a chance to talk.